occupational therapist and a certified aging in place specialist. And this is the Home Designs for Life podcast, your resource for aging in place and universal design. For more resources on aging in place, please visit my website, homedesignsforlife.com. There you will find my blog and more valuable information on how you can age in place and create a home for life. Hello, everyone, and thank you for being with me today. Today's guest is Alex Montoya. He is the creator of the Alex Montoya Foundation, and his foundation is a nonprofit organization to raise awareness of issues related to disabilities and immigration. He is also the author of 10 books. He is a motivational speaker, an educator on universal design, a social media influencer, and he is also an immigrant. Alex, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, I invited you after you were a guest for the University of Florida, the School of Journalism. My daughter is currently a student. She is working on a master's degree in social media strategy, and you were a guest in her class, and she was so moved by everything that you said and what you've done with your life and your journey, and she begged me to reach out to you, and you were so kind to accept my invitation to be on my podcast. And so I would love to talk about your journey, how life started for you in Colombia, and how you came to the United States, and how your life changed drastically and many doors were open for you. So the floor is yours.
Okay. Well, I'm really excited to be here, and thank you so much for the great blessing of being here. I am a author and speaker based out of San Diego, California. And my journey really began in Medellin, Colombia, almost 50 years ago. I had a disability immediately when I was born. I was born with a birth defect that caused me to be missing both of my arms and my right leg. And it looked like I had a life of really depending on others ahead of me, because Colombia at that time really didn't have the infrastructure to empower people with disabilities or have services available for them to go to school or anything like that. So when I was 4 years old, I moved to the U.S. courtesy of the Shriners Hospitals and received services from the Shriners and was given the chance to go to school and receive three prosthetics, two for my arms, one for my leg. And I have really tried to devote my life to being a pioneer, to being someone that educates others on accessibility and inclusion, and just try to make the world a better place for all of us.
Well, thank you, Alex, for everything that you do. And I wanted to ask you, so you left your country, Colombia, when you were 4 years old, is that correct?
Yes. Well, I first left when I was two to get fitted for prosthetics and see that they could work and they would fit me. And then by the time I was four, it was determined by my family that it was better to just stay in the U.S. permanently. I already had some family living up here. And so when I was four, I made the permanent move to be here.
And how did they learn about your condition and your
story?
Well,
it was really a miracle and nothing short of that. My mother's sister, my aunt, my tia, was living in California, and her husband was a security guard that just happened to be making his rounds one day at his job, and he literally bumped into a member of the Shriners organization. They truly had a chance encounter and a chance conversation. And the Shriner explained, because he was wearing a funny hat called a fez, and a fez is something, cylinder-looking hat with a tassel. My uncle was just genuinely curious, and he said, "Tell me about your hat." And the guy says, "Well, I'm a part of the Shriners. And my uncle says, "What's that?" And he says, "We're an organization that helps kids from South America and Central America. If they have orthopedic needs, we bring them to the U.S. and we take care of all their medical needs." And my uncle was floored because he said, "I have a nephew in Medellin, Colombia, that was just born a few months ago, and we don't know what to do for his future." And he explained about my birth and explained about my birth defect. And the Shriner said, "Oh, wow, that's the kind of kid we can take care of. We want to take care of him." And so they exchanged information. And a few months later, I was in the U.S.
That is an amazing story.
Yeah.
The universe.
Nothing happens by accident.
Everything. I completely believe that. Alex, tell me what your journey was like as a child. I know that you later went to college and you went to an Ivy League school and you earned a degree in sports journalism and you had a career doing that for a while. So tell us about your early life.
Well, my early life was really kind of an indication as to really what my life calling would be, in the sense that I was just trying to adjust to a new country, a new life, learning a new language, really adjusting to the American life. And on top of that, I had to adjust to learning how to use prosthetic limbs and being able to all of a sudden have mechanical arms and legs that I didn't have the first 3 years of my life. What surprised us was when my aunt and uncle, who really became a second set of parents to me, when they tried to enroll me for school, and we were told in San Diego that students with disabilities were only allowed on campuses that had special education only. In other words, a disabled student couldn't attend a regular curriculum school. It had to be a disability-only school. And that really surprised my family. And they explained, they said, "You know, our nephew has a physical disability, but mentally he is completely normal. Developmentally, he is normal. He is completely able. He needs to be learning with the rest of the kids and participate just as a normal student would do." And we were told that that was just not the case. And ironically, the school that I was placed in was right next door to a school for non-disabled or able-bodied kids. And they were separated only by a fence. There was a fence that separated the two schools. And so my first year at that school, my aunt and uncle spent that year advocating and lobbying for me to eventually be able to transfer over to the other school, because they recognized that I just needed to be in a regular setting and a regular environment. And there were actually a few of us kids that were in that situation. And so both the parents, as well as a few teachers and administrators, lobbied the school district. And eventually what they did was they kind of came up with a compromise. They allowed us to go over once a week to the other school and kind of provide a little bit of education for the teachers and for the students by means of a cooking class and by means of some other activities to just kind of see how we would do and see how the other kids would react to us. And it went so well that the following year, the school district changed its policy and allowed our group to become what they call mainstream and become the first students with disabilities on a regular education campus.
Great. So that is your first success story.
Yeah. And it was something that obviously we were so young that I don't think we really knew what was going on or kind of the long-term ramifications, but we certainly knew that we had been set apart and put on a different campus, and we knew why. And we could see that the campus that we wanted to go to and that our parents wanted to go to was bigger and nicer and had a bigger playground. And it was very evident that the kids over there didn't have crutches and prosthetics and disabilities. And so we knew that our responsibility or job was to advocate, to just be a part of that group.
Now, that's a perfect segue to one of your books, Alex Masters the Monkey Bars. So let's fast forward to now you are in a mainstream setting, you're attending regular classes, you're going out to what we call PE, physical education. So tell us about that story where you were in a situation in the monkey bars.
Sure. Well, very early on when I had been mainstreamed to the regular campus, I began making friends, and kids really had one of two reactions to me. They either wanted to know everything about my special arms and they wanted to ask a whole bunch of questions, or they were afraid and they really didn't know if they could approach me and what they could ask. And one day a group of new friends said, "Hey, why don't you come join us on the monkey bars in the playground?" And they were met with immediate opposition from another group of kids who said, "No, this probably isn't something that he can do. It probably isn't safe. Like, we shouldn't be doing this." And the friends that wanted me to participate, they advocated for me and they lobbied and they said, "No, he deserves to get a chance to play on the monkey bars." And it wasn't even something that I knew if I could do. And so I basically said, "Well, if these kids believe that I can do it, I want to do it. It looks fun. And let's give it a shot." And I began to climb the monkey bars, and I put my two hooks that I have here on my arms on the rungs of the ladder that I climbed, and I used my good leg, which is my left leg, to support my weight, and dragged my right leg up the ladder, and I made it all the way to the top and started going across. And by then, and mind you, I was only about 4 or 5 years old, and so were my friends. By then, everyone that had been there that day, there were about 10 kids, and the ones that said that I could go on there and the ones that said that I couldn't go on there, all of them were just so caught up in the moment. They were cheering and they were yelling and they were whistling, and girls were inviting me to prom, and it was crazy. They were supportive all the way until finally I reached about the middle part of the monkey bars, and all of a sudden the school bell rang and all the kids ran away, and they all ran because they had to go back to their classroom, and I was still up there on the monkey bars. And so it took a few minutes before a teacher came out. She noticed that I wasn't in class, and she said, "What the heck are you doing?" And I said, "Hey, I'm just hanging around." And she laughed and she held me down, but it taught me a really important lesson. It taught me an important lesson that I really carried throughout my whole life. It taught me the meaning of not being afraid to go after what you want. It taught me the importance of inclusion and how one feels when he or she is included and brought in to participate in things. And then it also taught me about just the value of not giving up, that there are times when things aren't going to go your way and you just have to not give up on it and just know that you're there for a reason. And I carried those lessons with me all throughout my life. And eventually I wrote a children's book about that particular story because I believe that it just illustrated some key things that kids need to know.
Yeah, that's a beautiful story. Personally, I was terrified at the monkey bars. So I totally stayed away from them. In fact, I did it once and I fell. I hit my head and actually passed out.
Oh my.
So I never did it again.
Yikes.
I was always impressed with what kids could do on the monkey bars.
Yeah.
But I wasn't going to try it. So now tell us about going to college. I know you went to an Ivy League school and you chose a career in sports, which people question, why would you do that? Tell us about how all of that came to be.
Well, I grew up in a very interesting and fundamental time. In my time in high school, the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed. So I was a sophomore when it was passed, and I was a senior when it became federal law. So I, first of all, I looked at my journey and just the fact that I was in the U.S., I believe, by miracle and by God's hand. And I realized that the impact, people would tell me, hey, I would never really even think about people with disabilities if I wasn't friends with you. And you're changing my own perspective. So with that, I wanted to go big. I wanted to really go somewhere where I could hopefully have an impact. And so I chose the University of Notre Dame, which is about 3,000 miles away from San Diego, California. It's in South Bend, Indiana, which is very close to Chicago. Very different type of weather, type of culture, and it is a considered an Ivy League school. Because of that, the campus is very old and was very slow to modernize and to include ADA modifications. And I knew that, first of all, I wanted to go to a place with wonderful education. I wanted to challenge myself and see if I could survive outside the cozy confines outside of California. And I wanted to go to a place where they maybe didn't have as much of a progressive spirit as California, and where the ADA was going to now give some teeth and be implemented. And I encountered several places on the university campus that weren't accessible, and they weren't going to become accessible unless students really started advocating for it. And I am proud to say that by the time I graduated, Notre Dame had gone from their disabled services was essentially a committee of people that met on the campus, a committee of administrators from different departments that met and basically talked about access or disability issues. And by the time I graduated, they saw that the need was a lot more sophisticated, a lot more nuanced. They were also going to have to do a massive overhaul of all of the buildings on Notre Dame's 150-year-old campus. And by the time I left, they opened a disability services center to be able to give as much attention to disabled services as they would anything else.
Have you been back since you graduated?
Several times. Notre Dame is a major part of my life still. It's a very cherished institution in my heart. It's a relationship where I've been very involved as an alumnus. And to see how access is implemented now, whenever they either build a new classroom building or they make modifications to the residence halls, it really warms my heart to know that it's just part of their culture now.
Well, that's wonderful. So tell us about your career in sports.
So one of my passions has always been sports. Ever since I was a kid, I have always been very passionate about a great deal of sports. Notre Dame, of course, is very well known for football, and I wanted to be part of the football fandom there. But I also harbored a lifelong dream of working for the San Diego Padres. And so when I graduated in 1996, I moved back to San Diego, and I began my journey of being able to work for the Padres. And I began by becoming a part-time usher with the team, and eventually got promoted into the corporate office, where I spent 10 years handling the Latino community outreach and marketing. And it was 10 very wonderful years. I, within that time, also got my master's degree, which is in sports management, to learn about just the sports industry. And it was great. It was really a great experience, and sports business definitely remains my passion.
Okay. And then you decided to go on your own, start your career as a motivational speaker, as an author. What made you make that leap?
Sure. Well, what a lot of people don't realize about sports teams is essentially they are corporations. They are a business and a for-profit business. And like any corporation out there, they have changes and restructurings and new ownerships and anything that you would see in any other corporate setting. And my position was about to be eliminated. And I had decided that I had spent 10 good years there and really enjoyed myself, but I was ready to try something new. Within that time, I had actually published my first two books, and it had really been more of a passion project for me, publishing and sharing my story and motivating others and then being invited to speak on my story. And I decided that since I was undergoing a new career change at the age of 42, that I wanted to explore this. And so I became a full-time speaker and author. And from that point forward, I wrote the rest of my seven books and also began assisting other authors in the process of writing their first books. And a journey of being either an editor or a co-writer or a ghostwriter for other authors as well. The business has lasted about 8 years and still growing and still going strong.
Oh, great. Congratulations. And I invited you here because as this podcast is about home modification, and I know that part of the topics that you educate on and talk about is universal design. And so I wanted to ask you, as someone that has challenges using homes as they're normally built, most homes are built for a family of four, people with no disabilities. In fact, they call it the Peter Pan home because they're built for people who never age. So educate us on how your condition has affected how you use your space and the things that you need and what makes a home comfortable for you.
Well, for certain, one of the greatest aspects of accessibility in the Americans with Disabilities Act has been structural access. Notre Dame, for example, took their main administration building where I had a literature class taught by the university professor, and it was on the third floor, and that building had no elevator. So I lobbied for a change, and sure enough, within a couple years, they agreed to do a whole renovation and actually shut that building down for a year in order to install, to make all kinds of modifications, but including installing elevators in the building. And I have seen where everything from automatic doors to levers instead of doorknobs to ramps, all of that has assisted me. And I know that it has assisted people with all kinds of disabilities, whether they are wheelchair users or are blind or visually impaired, or maybe they're deaf or any number of things. And I really began to realize that what we were talking about here is universal design and the aspect of creating things where all of us benefit from either having it digitized or having it be automatic or having it have different heights when necessary. So everything from desks to countertops that are lowered for people with mobility impairments. It has shown me that it's something that benefits everyone. And even now, when we have voice-activated software on our phones and our devices, and things that help us turn lights on and off, essentially being hands-free. What is remarkable is people are now starting to see that was at one point considered a tool, an assistive tool for people with disabilities, yet now everyone has benefited, and it's either made things either more secure or come from a place of convenience to being able to just help everyone.
I liken it to the comfort height toilet, that 17 and a half inches.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone benefits from a comfort height toilet, right? Unless you're a child, then you appreciate the 15-inch toilets.
Sure.
So how about in your own home? What changes have you made or changes that you would like to make in the future to accommodate you best so that you're able to be as independent as possible and then also live as comfortably as possible?
Sure. Well, I am a renter of an apartment, and so I have to operate within the parameters of my landlord, but I have not been afraid to make sure that all of my needs are met. So that's included installing an extra shower bar to be able to have better grip in getting into the shower. Just making sure that the doors are fully accessible. Obviously, even in just choosing a building that has an elevator instead of just stairs only. And then making sure that all of the public spaces that we have in our building are fully accessible. I have certainly caught on to the craze of hands-free devices. And again, for me, it's a matter of assistance and being able to gather more information or anything from my devices by being able to utilize the voice activated. But it's interesting to always see that people use it now really just as a comfort device or just for the sake of having things be a little easier. So definitely hands-free devices are probably the most common everyday things that I use.
Okay, and I'm glad you brought up the fact that you're a renter, because people who rent experience so many challenges to have their spaces modified. I mean, really, the challenges are across the board for everyone. But especially if you're a renter, it is really hard to ask for these things, have them paid for. In many cases, depending on where you live, the landlord will make you put the space back to what it used to look like at your own cost, which I believe is completely unfair. So I'm glad that you brought up those challenges, because many people experience those challenges, especially older people. Have you done any work to advocate for people with different abilities or perhaps older people that rent? I know that this is common in bigger cities because housing is limited, and then the cost of housing is also so high.
I'll tell you what my experience has been and what I've done. I certainly know that just as a disabled person, you have to be your best advocate going in. We tend to just look at things differently. So when I was examining my new home, I was certainly looking at it from a different set of eyes than probably most people would. And there's been a couple of times where I've actually explored other apartments that I potentially would move into. And I haven't been afraid to ask questions. I haven't been afraid to say, hey, I'm going to need this or I'm going to need that. Can you guys do it? Is that part of your policy? And some people say yes, and some landlords say no. But I've quickly learned who is the most amenable to changes and who is not. And it's just a reality of having a disability is that you are going to ask different questions than a person without a disability will. And you just need to be prepared to ask those questions and be your own best advocate and then move forward. Now, I'm very fortunate in that the apartment building that I'm in, I've lived in now for 10 years, and they've really gone out of their way to provide access and provide anything that I need. It's, you just have to continue to ask those questions and make your needs known to everyone. One thing that I try to do as an advocate is whenever I deliver a talk, whether it be a speech or a lecture in a class, I challenge the audience that, recognizing that chances are majority of them are going to be non-disabled, I challenge them to go and check out different restaurants or stores or things like that and look at them from a different set of eyes. My question to them is always, if you were to go to your favorite restaurant or bar or coffee shop with your friend that has a disability, could that person get in? And could that person maneuver around very easily? And constantly it's met with raised eyebrows and kind of, aha, people have never thought about that. People that are not disabled don't normally think in those terms. They normally will walk into a place and that's the last thing on their mind. So I challenge them to think about access whenever they frequent a place. And if they see that, oh, wow, this place is actually less accessible than I thought, and I can't even take my friend Alex here. My hope is that that just brings upon a change in a small way, but in an effective way.
I'm glad you brought up restaurants, because as an OT, I always think about access and how people use their space, how they navigate their space, especially when you're in public spaces. And with restaurants, for example, you don't even have to have an obvious disability to not be able to function in that space well. And the reason why I say that is, for example, if you go to a nice restaurant, they tend to have dim lighting. Well, our vision tends to change between the ages of 35 and 40. So you don't even have to be an older person to experience changes in your vision.
Right.
And I'm 45. And so one thing that happens to me every time, or something I experience every time I go to a restaurant, is that I cannot see the menu because there isn't enough lighting. And so right now I'm fine navigating the restaurant, but when it comes to seeing close up, I can't see what I have to see. But now with an older person, not only are they going to have trouble seeing the menu, but they may also have trouble just navigating the path of the restaurant, because you have tables, you have people walking around, you have servers that are carrying food, you know, you have noise, right? So there's all this stimulation that we're receiving auditory, visually, and now you've made the lights dim. And so you're really increasing everyone's fall risk.
Right. Yeah. And it's really kind of a double-edged sword of being a disabled patron. I make sure to be vocal whenever I frequent a place about everything from the lighting to also ensuring that they have paper menus still available, because a lot of places do not anymore. They just go with the QR code. Or making sure that they have straws, because some states ban straws altogether for environmental concerns. But making sure that they know that there are some people that need straws. And generally, I find that the places that I frequent the most make those accommodations, because they recognize I'm a regular and they want me to come spending my money. And so that's why I always tell people, even if you don't have a disability, I challenge you the next time you go to your favorite restaurant or coffee shop, ask yourself if your disabled friend could maneuver their way around there. And if not, what are you going to do about it? One of my favorite sayings or ideas is that a social movement doesn't become a social movement until the people that are not directly involved start caring. And it's especially the case when it comes to access issues for people with disabilities. Until the non-disabled community starts asking these questions and really start insisting on universal design, then things just don't get done. But that's always the goal, is to ask enough questions and have enough for presence that these changes are made.
Now, tell us about your career as a social media influencer. I know that you are on Instagram. What other platforms are you popular on?
Well, I have a pretty strong, pretty strong following on Facebook, Instagram. The Alex Montoya Foundation has an Instagram as well. And I'm on LinkedIn, Twitter, and TikTok.
You do all of them.
I do. As a small business owner, I find that I need to dedicate time each day to promoting my brand and promoting my business on there and letting people know what I'm doing. I mean, for example, earlier during this interview, I took a picture of you and me talking because I am going to promote it on my social media. But really, if you look at what social media is supposed to be about, connecting people and sharing your story and what your life is like daily, I really try to show people that's all I'm doing, is I'm trying to just show you my daily walk, my daily journey. And certainly that daily walk has some barriers and has some obstacles. For example, one of those obstacles in the past 3-4 years has been the proliferation of scooters in this country and the fact that there are more scooters than ever. And really, that's a phenomenon that's only about 5 years old, but there are scooters everywhere. And for myself, for someone that lives in an urban area, I live in downtown San Diego, a lot of people tend to take those scooters, which are motorized, and ride them on sidewalks because no one had ever told them not to. And so that provides a safety hazard for me and for anyone that has any sort of mobility need. And so I really have been vocal on social media, whether you want to call it advocacy or being an influencer or whatever you want to call it. I just simply brought up this concern and brought it up enough that eventually the city of San Diego started enacting policies to regulate how many scooters could be out there and where exactly people could ride them. 5 years in, it's a lot better than it was 4 years ago or 3 years ago, because there are policies there now.
Well, that's great. I never thought about that because I don't live in a downtown area, but it makes me think that is a huge safety concern for anyone using the sidewalk. But it makes me think about older people because they're going to have the same issues. Even if they're not using any type of mobility device, they may be slower. Their reflexes may be slower. They may not hear a scooter that is coming up behind them. They may not be able to see a scooter or something coming at them quickly. And when you think about the fact that we have 10,000 people turning age 65 every single day until the year 2035.
Wow.
That's going to be a lot of older people that are out and about. Mm-hmm. And when you consider how beneficial it is for an older person to live in a metropolitan area because they have access to transportation, they have access to healthcare services, access to restaurants and supermarkets. So it really is a hub for older people.
Right.
So it's definitely important that our cities are safe and maneuverable for everyone.
And it's really interesting because one of the other things that has impacted just universal design and access and our overall culture was actually the pandemic. And fortunately, in terms of something positive coming from a truly tragic situation, was the fact that, for example, more places offered delivery service, and they did so because of pandemic concerns. Well, that is also helpful for people with disabilities to have just more options available having something delivered to you, whether it be groceries or food products, but then also the, I would say, the consideration of social distancing and making sure that you have room to operate and room to move around. Again, social distancing was a term we didn't even know existed or would use before.
Or never want to use again.
And never want to use again. But I think because people are pretty, I would think, pretty used to having that be a part of just our routines and our cultures. And now, it's something that has benefited people with disabilities as well. And so again, all of these things people are realizing, everyone is realizing, might have been implemented for one reason, but it ends up benefiting all. And that's exactly what universal design is. I used the example of a curb cut on a sidewalk, how curb cuts were implemented because of the ADA, and they were implemented so that people in wheelchairs or scooters could safely and easily get on and off sidewalks. And now, of course, you see them used every day by everyone, including people with the ability to walk and people that are pushing strollers or bicycles. Today's generation has never lived in a world without curb cuts. But prior to 1992, there were absolutely entire cities without curb cuts. And it just has shown how much has changed.
Yeah. And I love that you brought up groceries being brought to your home, because that was one change that I made during the pandemic. Prior to that, I had always gone physically to the supermarket and purchased my groceries. And I really hated having to take the time to do that several times a week. And during the pandemic, I bought a membership to Instacart, and I still have it today, because Instacart is invaluable to people who work. It saves you so much time. So there's one service that many people can benefit from. And immediately after getting Instacart, I thought about how this would benefit so many more people, like older people. For example, a lot of my patients, they would ask me if I could take them to the supermarket to buy some groceries, or if when I was there, I could pick something up for them, because that was a challenge. They weren't driving anymore, and so it was a challenge to get people to take them to the supermarket. And unless you had money to pay someone, which I had patients that did this, they had a caregiver and they would pay someone to do these errands for them. But otherwise, you're kind of stuck. So I personally love Instacart, and they're not a sponsor of the podcast,
but they can.
But they could be if they wanted to.
But yes, absolutely. Everything from Instacart to our devices on our phones to automatic doors, curb cuts, as mentioned earlier, just implementing hands-free devices for hands-free technology for our devices, our TVs, our radios, our lighting, electronics. All of that is included in universal design. And I hope that people begin to realize that what is really happened either because of convenience, and that's really what it boils down to. I mean, when it came to the pandemic, things like Instacart became a matter of convenience because we didn't want to have to schedule our lives around going to the grocery store when nobody else was there. And at a time when it would be the least risk for the virus, it just became a matter of convenience. So whether it was that sort of convenience or just the convenience of doing three things at once, which we know we all do, especially moms, all of that ends up being something that goes from convenience to really being something out of necessity for people with disabilities. And if we can change the mindset to have that be the norm, I think we're all going to benefit. And like you say, our society is getting older quicker, and there's going to be more of us that do benefit.
Yes, thank you for adding all of that and your personal experience as someone who has different abilities and how you navigate the world. And really, you talked a lot about empathy, seeing the world through other people's eyes, even if that's not your own experience. And I think that's such a important thing to be able to do. Alex, thank you so much for coming on the show. I hope you'll come back and tell us about what you're doing in 2024 and the next book. Do you have a book that you're working on now?
Right now, we're just working on books for other clients. So no personal projects of my own, but I would encourage people to go online and check out the Alex Montoya Foundation at alexmontoya.org, or to go on Amazon, where my Amazon author page is, and to see the books that I have on there. Thank you again for this opportunity. This has just been an incredible blessing for me. And you're right. I think we need to continue to build a society of empathy and of action, and to know that we all benefit, and appreciate the chance. And whether people want to find me, Alex Montoya, on social media or check out one of my books, we should all work together and just make things better.
Yes, and I will include the links to your social media as well as to Amazon so that people can find your books. And I have a suggestion. I think your next book should be on universal design and accessibility.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Challenge accepted.
All right. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you so much.